I'm Jay Bradley Minnick from Arts and Letters Radio, and today we're presenting a special episode of Ars Poetica, a program created by our senior producer, Mary Ellen Cubitt, and hosted by both of us.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm Mary Ellen Cubitt.
And I'm Jay Bradley Minnick.
And this is Ars Poetica, a program where Arkansas poets discuss their work, their writing, and the connections it has with their lives. In today's episode, we feature poet Sandy Longhorn. We will be discussing her book, The Alchemy of My Mortal Form, as a reaction to the medical system in America that eventually impacts us all.
This book, to me, is really an indictment of what I call the medical industrial complex and what I saw as a daughter's view of my parents going through that system.
Sandy Longhorn's books include The Girlhood Book of Prayer and Myths, Blood Almanac, and The Alchemy of My Mortal Form, which won the Louise Bogan Award from Trio House Press.
Sandy received her MFA from the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, and a BA in English from the College of St. Benedict. She teaches at the University of Central Arkansas in the Arkansas Writers MFA program. Let's talk about poetry with Sandy Longhorn.
Writing from the inside of illness is not easy. How did you find your way into a book about the decay of the body?
At the time I was writing these poems, my father was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease, and I wasn't able to be there during his diagnosis and treatments and what ended up being quite debilitating for him. I often was my mother's support system as she had to fight and be an advocate for him. And I heard many, many stories of how difficult it was to get treatment. If not difficult to get the treatment, at least how much is the burden of the patient to make sure that they get the care that they need? And if you didn't speak up, then the medical industry was not going to go out of its way to help you. So that was happening. And at the same time, I had a cat, and it was diagnosed with a fever of unknown origin. We went through countless blood tests and biopsies and treatments, eventually even importing clean blood from Texas to do a blood transfusion for this cat. Our vet would go above and beyond. It would be 7 o'clock at night, and she would still be at the clinic working on what was wrong with our cat. And she would call us to tell us she had just consulted some veterinarian in Nashville, and they were going to bring this specialist in. And none of this broke the bank. All of this was completely affordable versus my dad trying to get care and having to negotiate insurance and doctors who wouldn't call my mom back and things like that. The sickly speaker, who is the character threaded through this book, is an example of someone who believes that the medical industry is there to help us, and then we watch what happens to her view of that system as she goes through getting treatment for a fever of unknown origin. Some forgotten fever. The bed is made of iron, flat and straight. My cursive spine breaks the line. To sleep, I turn on my side, wake to shoulder and arm aching. I rub the blood back to life. The sharper wounds I know sever my breath. This is the hint of extinction, coaxed away like smoke drifting. Yet in every exhale there remains a small forgotten fever that ruins muscle and bone and sweat-stained skin. Unlike any other book I've ever written before or since, the poems in this book that begin after the prologue section and end before the epilogue, the sort of meat of the book, all told by the same character, all told by the same speaker. I wrote the book in order. I did not know if the speaker was going to live or die. I did not know what the complications were going to be in her journey. She just kept telling me more and telling me more. And I ended up writing this book in about 11 months, which is very, very quick for me.
You know, I would call some of the prose lush. I mean, conceptually, as pushing together two senses of time, not just past and present, but maybe another time or another way of thinking about time.
Yes. And in fact, it stymies a lot of readers. Several readers have wanted to say that it's a Victorian book, that it's historical poetry in the way of historical fiction. And to me, it is completely contemporary. This is the voice of this speaker. And I kind of get away with that because she has this fever. And when we have fever, we enter delirium. Fevers of a minor fire. August, near the first. Dear madam, I address you with a tongue calloused and lumbering. Imagine the skein of my hair, humble and falling, neck ravaged. Based on your favored advice, I have passed some days burning the locked boxes my suitors sent me. The firelight refracted by the fever flush. Sweat on my brow and collarbone. As she ramps up in the early poems, she is fully in the flush of that fever. And then there's this sense of illness and the relationship between healing and those who can heal and the patient has been complicated from the beginning. There is a feral oath in my throat, dear lady, I confess it. I have pilfered many ounces of blood from my heart and placed them in the vial.
What about the feral oath in my throat?
Yeah, so that is this idea that when you're this sick, often our filters fall away and we may speak real truths without even knowing that we're speaking them. In the fire, the garnet fluid boils, holy and unholy, still. I have no prayers, but my bruised veins pulse beneath slack skin, pale and thin muscle cover. Madam, will you answer only this? The voice that steals along these walls and calls me to the flame, is it you speaking? It is a sweet and viscous sound, like the port I sip each night to bring me sleeping. I await your reply.
Can you explain to us what an epistolary poem is?
Epistolary is a fancy word that means letters. It means it looks like a letter on the page. It has an address. Sometimes it has a date. Then it will say dear and it will have the address to whom it's addressed.
In this collection, the epistolary poems are the letters the sickly speaker is writing to her mentor, the madam.
Yes. Do not be hurried. There is tinder enough to keep the fire and plenty of red meat to replenish the heart. Your subservient.
Okay, so there are three, in a sense, characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's the sickly speaker, who we are following along throughout the entire narrative of the book in her journey in a hospital or in an institution. Then there is the mentor who she writes these letters to that she refers to as Madam. And then we have the maternal figure who she refers to as
the woman I called mother by mistake. Tongueless, I conjure her at will. August. Dear madam, the woman I called mother by mistake brought me here when the sickness made me shiver, even in a scalding bath. The water lapped the edges, spilled in a cataract to the clean tiled floor. It soaked the towels there. She dried me with rough care and bore the weight of me to get my body here. There is nothing in this room that smells of her, though I request chrysanthemums. Let my fingers trail through their thick heads. I bring the musk to my mouth, breathing in such a way I might drown on the scent. I do not begrudge her leaving. I saw her eyes when my lips formed the word. We both knew I was orphaned then. Your refugee. So the sickly speaker is a woman abandoned by everyone, abandoned by anyone who is meant to help her or set up to be someone who can bring care for her.
An advocate, yes.
And
many patients experiencing chronic illness sometimes cannot see the actual reality of the situation, or they are not able, because they are sick, to possibly understand what they need or understand the questions to ask. And therefore, an advocate is needed to come in and help negotiate the industrial medical complex, as you discussed it.
And that's definitely one story that I think readers are very familiar with, is the idea that someone without an advocate will often simply be left to live a life of very low quality and may, in fact, pass away early because of that. In this case, the sickly speaker is alluring to the white coats because she has a fever of unknown origin. She has a puzzle that must be solved. And if the white coat can figure out what's wrong with her and save her, then the white coat gets acclaim and stardom. And so she is not left by the wayside. She is actually embraced into this institution or this hospital as they try to solve the puzzle of her.
So the mystery of her fever of unknown origin is what compels the white coats to keep trying to figure out what's going on.
Right, even when she has no advocate.
And she's lonely. The next poem says, "This fever is my tutor."
I have gone shimmering into ungentle sleep. This fever is my tutor. It lectures scarlet on my cheeks, pale quarter moons on all my fingernails, a heart that gallops beneath the cold sting of a stethoscope unleashed. I repose and ripen with the weight of secrets, for I swore an oath to silence. This bed, my penitentiary, though my chains pointless, cotton woven. Part of that penitentiary is her body can't move. She's too weak. She is restricted. And that, I think, is a very common feeling from people who lose mobility in illness, is that they are jailed in some way by their own body. Lethargy of limbs, another symptom pressed into the chart. The noise of the pen blisters the brain. The catheter in the vein delivers ruination, dreams induced to knock my damaged crown askew. When I wake, my bones have been replaced with porcelain, sinew altered to wire, and my tongue lets loose what once was barred and guarded. So all she has is the input of her body in illness. She no longer has anyone to lead her.
You're listening to Ars Poetica. Let's return to our conversation with Arkansas poet Sandy Longhorn.
So my typical process is I'm reinventing the wheel every time I sit down to write a poem. I have some idea of what I'm writing and where it might go, but the poem really teaches me how to write it as I'm writing it. With this, because she has such a distinct voice and it is not my voice, I always had her voice to start. The first lines always came to me in her voice. At night, I return to your tutorage. Recite the root causes of loss. Flame, water, wind, and ice. There is no trumpet song of triumph for those lost in the delta of disease.
There is no trumpet song of triumph for those lost in the delta of disease. How true is that? So is there triumph? Is the triumph being well? Is the triumph being whole?
Or is the triumph maintaining a sense of self throughout the illness and whatever's coming? Is the triumph being able to accept your mortality and accept this broken system that we have without losing hope? We crouch in shadows, in the never fully dark. Madam, I beseech you, send on the next lesson. My exhaustion is complete.
My exhaustion is complete.
My exhaustion is complete. The ashes of my familiar. Another woman kept this room before me, I am sure. There is a husk of her temper yet that rides the air. When I breathe in the burnt remains, a strengthening returns. Rest assured, we are conjoined in anonymity, although I learned she died with her eyes open, if the nurses may be trusted.
And then, of course, there is the white coats, the nurses, and the mystics, who are kind of the characters on the tangent, mm-hmm. who come in and give the sickly speaker the treatments, the therapy, the medication, the food, etc.
When the white coats come, I invoke the posture of the pasture, a flat expanse they trample in the search for the root of my disease. The charm is in the way they wring their hands when I ask after my pretty predecessor. I've found a strand or two of her red, red hair, cradled now and hidden well, the beginning of a new concoction self-prescribed. If I could find a fingernail or the remnant of a ribbon used to lace her nightshirt closed, I would be closer to the completion of my healing.
The completion of my healing could be
It could be the end. Either thing, right? She doesn't know, right? She's on a cusp. She doesn't know what her outcome is going to be. I live to see the day the white coats arrive to find me unwavering in my form. The day I stand before them whole and walk away with the shadow of my bedmate, my mysterious, my true physician who does no harm. She certainly says she wants to be strong. She wants to be whole. And she's finding that her own prescriptions are doing more to heal her than the doctors are doing. Just her recognition that she is not the first to go through this. And yes, that this is the reckoning of the nurses have told me this woman died. So confronting mortality again, confronting what kind of death might I have if I don't heal. But for her to completely heal, she has to give up this thing that has been her identity, which is a fever. So they have to force her to loosen her hold on the fever. The body's instinct is to bloom. So this is what it means to conquer the fire of fever, to go days, weeks, and now months without a sizzle behind the tongue, beneath the skin, drizzles of sweat no longer making rivulets along the throat's curve. The body tamed is health. I must forgive the white coats for how they forced my hands to loose their hold on the pyrite and the flint.
At one point you say, my hands to loose their hold on pyrite and the flint.
That has to do with her at first feeling blame for having a fever. She herself must have done something to cause the fire of the fever. Striking the pyrite and the flint, causing the fire, causing the flame. I had grown so used to trafficking in ash. The white coats saved the root of me, enough healthy flesh kept hidden from the flames to offer this rebirth, though I often fought their tugs, their scrapes, their marriage of brutal antiseptics to this fiery pit. Compliant now, under their smooth-fingered grazing, I allow them to lift, pinch, and shift newly muscled limbs, to persuade the new growth forming on the budding branches. Sometimes when we have a really serious illness, it becomes our whole identity, and that is what draws attention to us. And so to heal, we have to give up that identity. Eleven General Orders of a White Coat. Approach the body by praying without distinction. Harass the Union of Disease, the army of invaders. Root out the pickets, scouts, foraging parties. Use the greatest vigor of movement in the attack. In the military, you can look up the Army's 11 general orders to a soldier, and you will get these imperatives. And I was really thinking about the way medicine attacks illness, and therefore doctors have to be something like soldiers. This is one of the reasons why they do distance themselves from the patient, right? Because they have to cause harm to the body to heal it. Sacrifice the body in order to find what may be saved. Form rotations to battle the degenerate blackness of night. Expect profound repercussions at daybreak. Lance the wounds and let the poison seep. Acknowledge some good blood may be lost in the preservation. Be vigilant. Watch for signs of a stalled heart. Keep the weapon at the ready, a loud report to shock the pulse.
Because of the military language, and because culturally, right now, we have a tendency to use military language when fighting chronic illness. We're in a battle. We have this metaphor of fighting disease. We hear that phrase, they lost their battle with cancer, almost like somehow they didn't fight hard enough.
It's an indictment, the book, of a system that we ourselves have built in this country. Some of us rail against it and try to change it, but it's a behemoth.
Are your parents still alive?
My father passed away. My mom's still alive.
Has your mom read the book?
Oh, yeah.
What does she think?
She loves everything that I do, and often she'll say things like, you've really transformed those experiences, you know.
She knows.
She can see that, yes. Cloaked in darkness and in health. June. Dear Madam, I send this letter in advance of my escape. The white coats hint at my release, but offer only obstacles. Their latest word is destitute. A mystic offers up the ledger of my debts. My sins have stretched the leather, the spine imperiled by the list of potions and procedures. When my body burned beneath their hands, when my veins resisted their prescriptions, the white coats found me fashionable, a test of their true aptitudes, a quest to set their names in bold font, spinning through the profession. But I am passing wholesome now, have become a burden taking up a bed with no means for repayment. I will not demean the woman I called mother by mistake, by revealing her. I refuse the mystic's pleading and her threats. Each night, I work more quickly at loosening the bars at the window. Each day, I memorize the path I'll take. Expect me 3 nights past the new moon. I'll be insolvent, hungry, in need of just enough to make my way. You're fixed and penniless.
You know, you do end with in health a little bit. And I'm just wondering, is there something we can take from it? I get it. I understand it's an indictment. But there's this hope that she's going to be able to get out. She's saying, expect me. Mm-hmm. She hasn't left yet.
But only to be in need of just enough to make my way. She's not going to stay with the mentor. She's going to remain alone. But yes, the journey has been that she is passing wholesome now. She is growing new buds. There is hope that this process has worked for her. But if you've gone through this kind of thing, you know that you are never able to simply go about your life believing you'll be healthy forever now. So there's always going to be this suspicion that it could come back or that the relapse could happen at some future date.
And she might be free of the burden of the fever, but she's not free of the burden of the debt.
Exactly. And there's an accounting, both financial and emotional, for this journey. She'll never be free of those two things. Health and expanded definition. Sound condition of the body. As in, able to lift the wet laundry, to pin the full-grown heft of it to the line. As in, legs that could brace for and bear the weight of an ordinary burden. As in the will to scab, to seal over the minor wounds rather than to fester.
As I reread this, that struck me in new ways about chronic illness and illness of family members.
You don't want to say, well, thank goodness that happened, right? You never want that to be the case, but I think it really added weight to the fact that it doesn't matter if we isolate what illness the sickly speaker has, because the point is more about the experience of being ill and being treated. So I'm happy for people to read it and to read in whatever situation applies to them or whatever situation comes up for them. I'm very happy for that to happen.
Thank you for explaining some things
of
to
course.
Us. And thanks for being here. And this is beautiful work.
Thank you. And thank you both for having me. But most importantly, thank you for the careful attention to the poems and also for holding up poetry in Arkansas and shining a bright light on it.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Ars Poetica, presented by Arts and Letters Radio. Thank you for joining us. To check out the episode information, visit artsandlettersradio.org.
A big thank you to Silas Hype for producing, editing, composing the music, and mixing and mastering the episode. Generous funding for Ars Poetica was provided by UA Little Rock's Summer Research and Creative Activities Fellowship from the College of Humanities, Arts, Social Sciences, and Education. An extra special thank you to poet Sandy Longhorn for sharing her perspectives, personas, and poetry.
For Ars Poetica, we're Mary Ellen Cubitt
and J. Bradley Minnick.
And don't forget to support local poets in your community. Poetry books change lives. Ars Poetica is a production of LTD Media, Inc.